Good afternoon, everyone, and a warm welcome to everyone. This is your host, Keith Bird, in Calgary, Alberta, Canada. I'm pleased to welcome you to a fresh recording of the OSL telephone conference call that was held on Sunday, January 21, 2018, with our guest speakers, Sheila, Dennis, and Matt Lynn. If you were a participant on that call on January 21, you will remember there were technical difficulties prevented listening hearing one of the speakers. So for that reason, the call is being re-recorded. The questions that were asked during the call, unfortunately, were not noted. And so we'll do our best to address what perhaps we think the questions might be that you would have. We'll get started in just a moment, but first let us pray. Loving Heavenly Father, we praise you for who you are and thank you for your loving kindness and goodness to us. We thank you for giving us your Son Jesus, who by his sacrifice made it possible for us to become your children and to open the way for us to call you Father. We welcome your Holy Spirit with us today and ask your blessing on our speakers and for each one who will be listening to this recording. May this be a time of healing for us all. We offer this to your praise and glory in the name of our risen Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ, who lives and reigns with you in the Holy Spirit, one God, now and forever. Amen. Sheila, Dennis, and Matt Lynn are widely known for the many books they have written and as popular speakers for healing events throughout the world. They are lovingly remembered as keynote speakers and workshop leaders for the Order of St. Luke North American conferences and other OSL healing events. I was blessed to have met Matt to participate in his cemetery in Calgary, Alberta, last fall. Our guests today will be addressing the gifts of near-death experiences. It is my pleasure to welcome Sheila, Dennis, and Matt to the call. Welcome.
Thank you, Keith.
Thank you for having us, Keith.
We're delighted to have you with us. Sheila, may I ask you to begin?
Yes, thank you. And welcome to everyone who's listening. Thank you for being with us. We are going to speak for a while, conclude with a healing process, and there will be a space in there for questions. This presentation is based on our book, The Gifts of Near-Death Experiences. You don't have to die to experience your true home. For those of you who are not familiar with this, a near-death experience, or NDE as it's popularly known, is an experience in which people who appear to be dead or in danger of death leave their body, find themselves fully conscious in another realm, and then return to this life. And I want to begin by telling you how we came to write a book on near-death experiences and to be giving a presentation like this one, since we are not researchers in this field, and none of us have had an NDE, at least not that we remember. So here's what happened. A few years ago, our friend Fran was visiting us, and Fran is one of the most courageous people we know. She speaks up publicly about an issue that other people get killed for speaking up about. And we asked her, "Fran, where do you get your courage?" She said, "I get it from reading about NDEs. I've read about them every day for 10 years, and I am not afraid to die." And she showed us the book she was reading at the time. It was Lessons from the Light by Kenneth Ring. And we've always been interested in NDEs, and we had read some about them. But we had not read Lessons from the Light. So we got it, and we read it, and we really loved it, especially Ken Ring's thesis, which is that the NDE is like what he calls a benign virus, meaning that we can catch it. We can experience some of the effects of an NDE without having to die ourselves, or nearly die, simply by immersing ourselves in accounts of other people's NDEs, by talking to them or reading about their experiences. Also, we noticed that the typical stages of an NDE parallel the healing processes that we have included in our books and retreats all over the world for years, because we find they are universally healing. That word universal is important to us. So we were really impressed when we realized that Ken calls NDEs the universal donor, because they transcend all religions and cultures, just as we had experienced with our these healing processes that we had developed. So again, we felt a resonance between our work and NDEs in terms of that universal quality. And we felt very inspired to write our next book about how the healing processes we use could help people catch the benign virus of the NDE. Because we were following Ken Ring's thesis, we wanted to tell him what we were planning and make sure it was okay with him so he didn't feel like we were kind of copying his work. And we were able to get his email address, and we wrote him, and he wrote back, and one thing led to another. And he's now a really beloved friend, and he ended up writing the foreword to our book. So what we're trying to do is put together a world that we know well, the world of pastoral ministry, with the world of pioneers in the field of near-death studies like Ken Ring. And as we do that, we are catching a major case of the benign virus, and it has helped us so much in our own lives that we want to pass it on to others, to you. We want to be contagious. So we're glad we're here and that Keith has given us the opportunity to talk about this, and we're glad you're listening. Thank you for being here.
Yeah, Sheila mentioned why we are interested in NDEs. We've always tried to integrate spirituality, psychology, and medicine. And medicine and psychology, we're starting to really focus on NDEs because they're so widespread and they were well documented. There's a site on the internet, IANS, International Association for Near-Death Studies, that has 4,000 different persons that are have been interviewed and that are on their talk with their documenting their NDEs, and it's from over 30 countries. Between 4 to 15% of the world's population has had an NDE, and one reason that there's so much more information, this explosion of information about NDEs, and is because there's more openness to them. There's more resuscitations. Nurses, instead of getting a psychological intervention, are listening to the person, and they're encouraging people to talk about them. And because there are more resuscitations, there's more people talking. So this means that hospital personnel are more interested in NDEs. Now, this has led to more research on NDEs, to the point that cardiologist Pin Van Lommel could do a prospective study that was written up in Lancet, which is the medical journal over in England. And there have been many others, at least three of them have been prospective studies. Prospective studies are studies made right when the person has had it, rather than retrospective studies much later when it's less remembered. And what these show us is that the stages are basically consistent across cultures. For example, in the ongoing study that IANS has of 4,000 NDEs from over 30 countries, they find that, this is a quote from them, whether it's a near-death experience of a Hindu in India or a Muslim in Egypt or a Christian in the United States, the same core elements are present in all. Out-of-the-body experience, tunnel experience, feelings of peace, beings of light. Often they see people that are deceased coming in and caring for them. A life review, reluctance to return, and transformation after the NDE. In short, the experience of dying appears similar among all humans, no matter where they live. And what they're really looking at, too, are the after effects, the transformation effects. One of the persons who did that is the cardiologist, Van Lommel, and he followed up with people 2 years after they've had it and 8 years after it. And he compared what happens to those that have had a cardiac arrest but didn't have the NDE with it, and what happens with those who had the cardiac arrest but had the NDE with it. What is attributed strictly to the near-death experience, not just the fact that they've died? And here's what he says after his studies of over 8 years. People who have NDEs or near-death experiences, they typically change, often rapidly and dramatically. And these changes are strikingly consistent across cultures, races, and creeds. They're generally not what would have been expected from pre-existing societal beliefs, religious teachings, or any other source of earthly knowledge. NDEs change in the following ways. They grow in love, compassion, self-esteem. They tend to become more spiritual and less religious. Example, church attendance goes down. They lose all fear of death. They have an abiding sense of being loved unconditionally. They realize that all that really matters in life is to love and to learn. And he found that NDEs, like the loving part, they were 5 times more involved with social justice than those who had the cardiac arrest but without the NDE. They were 3 times more wanting to help others. And the learning part, they listened to others 6 times more than those who just did not have the NDE. Now, the other reason, besides that these are being investigated, we have more NDEs and the medical personnel are paying more attention to them, is the medical model is changing. Before, it used to be that NDEs were just dismissed. Medicine was saying it was just a chemical reaction from a dying brain. There's a whole new thing that's happening, what's happened before, but it's being recorded now, called shared near-death experiences, where others, besides the person who is dying, share in this near-death experience. And one of the ones that has brought that focus on it is Raymond Moody. And he's written a book called Glimpses from Eternity. And part of the reason it came is he had an experience of with the death of his mother. How others, his whole family was around the bed, and they were experiencing what she was experiencing. And here's what he wrote. He said, as we held hands around the bed, the room seemed to change shape. 4 of the 6 of us felt as though we were being lifted off the ground. I had the feeling that the room had turned into the shape of an hourglass. I felt a strong pull, like a riptide that was pulling me out to sea, but the pull was upward. Look, said my sister, pointing to a spot at the end of the bed. Dad's here. He's come back to get her. And everyone there reported later that the light in the room changed to a soft and a fuzzy texture. It was like looking at light in a swimming pool at night. As all of this took place, there was great joy. We all knew something truly incredible had happened to all of us as our mother had died. It was as though the fabric of the universe had torn, and for just a moment, we felt the energy of that place called heaven. I had an experience when I was giving a retreat, a nurse came with talked about a shared near-death experience. She said I was taking care of a patient. Her mother was dying. And we saw this tunnel of light go from mother who was dying through the room and to the door. And it was a tunnel for 45 minutes of light, even though we had the blinds closed. It was just coming from that, right from the mother. And at the moment that the mother died, the daughter and I looked at each other because we saw that same moment, her spirit exit from her and go through the tunnel. So I asked her, I said, 45 minutes of this tunnel, did anybody else ever see that too? And she said, yeah, when we saw the tunnel, we called in 4 other nurses and they saw the same thing. So that's 6 people with healthy brains, daughter, 5 nurses, that are experiencing the near-death experience. you can't just dismiss it as this is hallucinations coming from a dying brain. And doctors are experiencing them. I went on YouTube, and there's 21, I just write in, doctors having near-death experiences. And 21,000 citations showed up. So this is being accepted. It's a reality. And that's one of the reasons we wanted to look at it more.
I would like to talk about a game that is probably familiar to many people. It's musical chairs, and Matt mentioned that NDEs transcend religions and cultures. Our work is giving workshops, and we've given workshops across many cultures and religions. And we usually try to play musical chairs because we find that there's a version of musical chairs in just about every country or every culture that we work in. I'm going to talk about how musical chairs not only transcends cultures, but how it also exemplifies the changes that people experience in a near-death experience. I think those who are familiar with musical chairs will remember that you play some music, and each time you have a group of people going around the chairs, and when the music stops, everybody tries to go for a chair. And always, in each round, you remove one chair so that by the end, you have one person in the chair who's the winner. So, for instance, we just did this in Mexico, and we had 7 volunteers. So you put 6 chairs in a circle, and you start the music. And at the end of the first round, you know, you take away another chair and another person, whoever's left standing. And you keep doing that until there is one winner. Now, that's the way that musical chairs is typically played. One winner. And in the case in Mexico that I'm referring to, there would be 6 losers. Now, what we do is to play it a second way. To us, the first way represents, you know, competition. It represents the rules that many of us play by in society, where really there's one winner. We change one rule to playing it the second time, and the rule is that after the music stops, we remove a chair as usual, but more than one person can sit on any given chair. So that by the end, you have one chair remaining and 7 people giggling and trying to hold on to each other and to somehow situate each other on that one chair. In other words, there are 7 winners. I remember the last time we played it in Mexico, our 15-year-old son was on the bottom, and there were six senoras on top of him, you know, coming from many different social classes and backgrounds. It's a way for everybody to experience we are one and everybody wins. When we ask people which way they prefer playing, just about everybody will say we prefer the last way. And when we ask them why, they will say, well, the first way is, you know, it's the way our culture runs. There are winners and there are losers. And in the second way, there's cooperation and we try and make everyone a winner. We try to hold everyone together, to recognize that we are one. To us, that is the main change. Matt was talking about changes that happen when you have an NDE. It's like the people who come back change the rule in their life. They can no longer live in a competitive economic system where there's one winner, everybody else loses. Somehow, they try to make the changes in their life so that everybody wins. And Matt described some of those changes. how they reach out to others in new ways, find new jobs, new ways of living. So to us, as we're talking here, an image to keep in mind is musical chairs number one versus musical chairs number two. In musical chairs number two, everyone wins. And that's what we find when people return from a near-death experience. That's what they try to do. They try to live in a way that that happens.
We began studying and writing about near-death experiences for a number of reasons, some of which I have already shared. And also because we were convinced of their relevance for many areas of ministry, which is our work, and for just being with people in a caring way, which is something I think all of us want to do. A few years ago, Denny and I had a kind of crash course in exactly how relevant NDEs are for a very common issue in ministry and in life, which is accompanying people who are grieving. What happened was that our son, John, had been friends with a boy named Zeke since they were babies. His family are our neighbors, and the two boys grew up together. The summer before John's sophomore year in high school, Zeke had an accident on his mountain bike, and he suffered a severe head injury. After the accident, Zeke went into a coma, and he never came out of it. His family called us to stay with them in the hospital, where he died 5 days later. Zeke was 15 years old. He was almost entirely brain dead when we got there, with no activity above the brainstem. And his parents had to decide to take him off life support and let him go. Even though it had been clear to Zeke's family from the first moment they saw him in the emergency room that he was not in his body any longer, the turning point in their ability to let him go came as they fully grasped that he was still there, but in a different way. And there were many signs of this. For example, Zeke's brother and sister were having dreams in which Zeke spoke to them and seemed to be guiding medical decisions that needed to be made. Several of Zeke's friends saw him or heard him. And Zeke appeared to a close friend of the family in Mexico who didn't even know yet about the accident. And she heard Zeke say, "I'm here." We could wholeheartedly encourage Zeke's family to trust these experiences and really take them in because of the extent to which we had immersed ourselves in NDEs by then. We knew the territory, and we could share with the family stories of other people who had had experiences with dying loved ones similar to what was happening between them and Zeke. So they could trust these experiences. It wasn't weird. It wasn't strange. It was normal and typical. That's what they began to see, and they began to listen and trust what was happening. And finally, when we sensed that they were ready, we asked the family to gather with us around Zeke's bedside. We invited each person to hold his hand or touch his face and in turn tell Zeke what they loved about him and how they wanted him to continue to be with them and take care of them. And after that, the energy of the whole situation shifted, and it was really palpable. The family could now trust that taking Zeke off life support and letting his body go was the best way to stay connected to him. They were donating Zeke's organs. Zeke had made it clear that that was what he wanted. So we all went into the operating room together, and they disconnected the tubes and the wires and so forth, and we let him go. And Denny sensed Zeke's presence up above the doorway. Zeke was watching us watch him leave his body, die. Then the family asked us to preside at the memorial service, which was held at the school that Zeke had attended with John. 1,000 people came. The whole community was distraught with people in various stages of shock and grief. It's a very diverse community with a wide range of beliefs, and we basically guessed what to do, which is that in a much simpler and briefer way, we did with them what we had done with Zeke's family in the hospital. We spoke about how close the deceased are to us, and we referred to near-death experiences. The heart of the service was when Zeke's sister shared one of her dreams, in which Zeke spoke to her very clearly. This is while we were all in the hospital. And we led the whole group in telling Zeke what they loved about him and how they wanted him to continue to be with them and take care of them. Evidently, we guessed right what to do, because people who were there at the memorial service, strangers to us, still come up to us on the street and thank us and tell us how much that service meant to them. It seems that our openness to NDEs increased our awareness of Zeke's ongoing presence, and that then gave us an intuitive sense of how to be present to Zeke's family in the hospital and then to the larger community at the memorial service. And evidently, this helped many people trust in a world of love and connection that transcends death. This includes Zeke's classmates. Right after the memorial service, John would come home from school and tell me, "Mama, all the kids at school think you and Papa are really cool." Now, I never have thought of myself as cool, but apparently this went back to the memorial service, and I think what they were trying to say is that we gave them permission to trust a kind of knowing they still have as teenagers, but that kind of knowing isn't usually encouraged in our culture. And we in the family have heard stories from friends of Zeke's who sense his presence or he comes to them in a dream, as if the memorial service opened a door and made it okay to trust these kinds of experiences and to share them. And I experienced Zeke's presence myself. He was an easygoing, playful kind of kid who laughed a lot. And I, on the other hand, tend to be serious. So when we were gathered around his bed in the hospital telling him how we wanted him to be with us, I asked him to help me be less serious. And, you know, his death was a tragedy. But since he died, I often sense him saying to me, "Don't worry, everything's okay, relax." And I usually do feel more relaxed, as if Zeke is sharing with me his way of being, more playful, less serious. So I've given you an example of how exposing ourselves to NDEs can help us accompany people who are grieving. But we believe that catching the benign virus of NDEs can help us with any issue in being a loving, caring human being. The basic message of NDEs is that we are held in infinite, unconditional love, and that this love is the essence of everything in the universe, including ourselves. We are the light, and so is everyone else. And when we know this, then we can hold that loving space of light for ourselves and for others as they find it for themselves. Matt?
Yeah. One element of NDEs that I find especially helpful is the life review. And the focus of the life review is how we have been hurt and how we have caused hurt. So this results in being able to understand and being able to forgive ourselves and being able to forgive others. In the life review, we don't just watch a movie of all that we've done in our life. We re-experience, relive each event, feeling everything just as when it happened. And we also relive our life, not just from the point of our own shoes, but from the point of view of every person with whom we've interacted. Let me give you an example. In Mexico, we spoke about the life review, and Guillermo came to me and shared how his life review changed his whole life. He said, "I was the hitman for the drug lord, and I'd killed over 30 people. And on the way to shoot another person, I had this in a car accident, and I died. I was taken into this loving light, and I began to relive every moment of my life. I especially experienced each time that I shot another person, how the bullet shattered me in my agony as I was dying. I was also in the shoes of my victims' families. I experienced how as his wife, I couldn't feed my own family. I was their children. I was starving. So when I returned to life, I went back to the drug lord. I said, I can't do this anymore. I can't kill people. He understood that. I couldn't kill anyone. I got another job. I now take whatever I earn and I give it to feed the families of the children I've orphaned and when I killed their fathers. Now I feel at peace. I feel happier than I've ever been. So what becomes clear from the life review is that nothing's ever lost. The golden rule is literally true. Whatever we do to others, we really are doing to ourselves. We'll be in their shoes. Like Guillermo, we're the ones who judge ourselves. Always in an atmosphere of this infinite, unconditional love, that light that Guillermo experienced. And this can bring a whole new depth, whole new significance to a process that we teach it during every retreat, and we call it the examen, which is it's an updated version of the examination of conscience. And the way we've used it is to invite people to reflect on what they're grateful for and what they're not so grateful for from each day. And since we're in the process of catching the benign virus, we do the examen with the question in the back of our minds, what if I were doing this during my life review? How will I relive this day then? What will I be grateful for and not so grateful for? And to what extent, you know, did I live this day consistent with the light, with the love that I am? Now, I ask myself this even with small decisions. Let me give you an example. I had to decide whether to go to my nephew John's lacrosse game. As the team's goalie, he had a lot of responsibility, and he appreciated all the support that he could get. But, you know, the game was 3 hours away, which meant that if I went, I'd be giving up a whole day. I'd be spending it out in the cold. They play lacrosse in blizzards. The forecast was 28 degrees Fahrenheit and a 20-mile-an-hour wind. And if I didn't go, hey, I could get a lot of work done in my warm, cozy room. It seemed like it's a no-brainer. I'm going to stay. But since I was trying to make a decision in the light of the near-death life review, I decided to see if that's going to change anything. So first I imagined myself watching my life review if I stayed home, and then if I went. I imagined myself in John's shoes, feeling how much it meant to him to have me come and how we'd get closer afterwards as we shared the game's highlights. And going to the game, be more loving than staying in my room, doing the work that I could do another day. Again, it seemed like a no-brainer, but this time it had the opposite outcome. So I went to the game. And John's team won 15-4. I was there to celebrate with him. That's one of the moments I most look forward to reliving in my life review. Now, these life reviews show us where we are on track, moving, giving, and receiving in this deep life, deep love. That is our purpose of life. It's being the love that we really are. And NDEers experience that. They come back with a sense of their purpose of life. Many of them get into helping professions. And the survey that we talked about before, 80% significantly increase their concern for others. And often they change professions. In Australia, 65% had a career change to get into a helping profession. And the ones who are sent back, it's usually some way that they are going to care. Mothers typically come back caring to care for their children. And they come back in a more caring way. They drop destructive ways of living that before took away life, addictions, pursuing money, fame, power. Let me give you an example. Gordon Allen, he was a ruthless financier named the CEO of the year, and he was on two financial magazines, Financial World and Tycoon of the Decade, on the magazine Success. His love was making money. When hospitalized for pneumonia, he had an NDE. He was filled with his unconditional love. He knew life was about loving, not his empty pattern of making money. So he left his career, and then he made phone calls to all the people that he had cheated before, asked forgiveness. Then he went to school to be a qualified counselor. And he now lives simply helping, especially those who have suffered injustice. The richness, and he says that his whole life has changed. He says, the richness of my life is like the Sistine Chapel compared to a plain, drab room somewhere. So once again, this daily reflection process we call the examen takes on a whole new depth and significance because when we do it regularly, we begin to see a pattern of loving. And that pattern can help us find the purpose of our life. And when we live in a way that's consistent with this light and this love that we are, we're living our purpose. We're living as our true self. That's the goal of the spiritual journey. Dennis?
What Matt mentioned with Gordon Allen and examples of people changing professions is that we become more loving. And a way to say that is we really begin to remember who we are. And that's what I want to talk about, how we come back and remember who we are. And an image that I have for how we remember who we are is that we live in Vail, Colorado, and there is a stretch of road from Vail to Santa Fe that we've probably taken 50 times. The reason it's so special is that on that road we have climbed the 14ers, the snow-capped mountains. We've fished many of the streams. And it's like when we make that trip, we have so many memories to the extent that we almost know what's going to be on the other side of a curve. Now, here's what has been very, very surprising, is that near-death experiencers report something very, very similar, that when they have this experience, yeah, there are snow-capped mountains, there are streams with fish, there's everything that I see on the highway between here and Santa Fe. I mean, that's surprising enough. Somehow I thought, you know, the next life was something spiritual, as if you couldn't have mountains and streams and fish and all the beauties of nature that I see on that road. But here is what's really surprising, is that they report, for instance, when they're coming around the side of a mountain, that they know what's going to be on the other side of the curve, just like I do in the trip between Vail and Santa Fe. That's right. Near-death experiencers tell us that there's all this beauty of nature, and they remember they've been there before they were born. And many people say it's like an experience of coming home, home at last, something they remember. In short, it's a way of remembering who they were, even before they were born. Now, here's the other surprising part of it now. All these aspects of nature are there, and Matt mentioned the life review. And what many near-deathers experiencers report is that in their life review, that they do a life review about how they've treated all the different aspects of nature, the air, the water, the trees, all those different encounters that we have had in our lives with nature are part of our life review. Now, that was pretty startling to me. We experience how we have cared for it and how we have not cared for it. I remember Berkeley Mills, in his life review, he remembered when he was 8 years old and very proud. He had a slingshot and he killed a mother bird. In life review, he was no longer feeling the pride of killing a mother bird, but he was inside those baby birds, each one of them, in their shoes, as they were dying, and feeling what it's like to starve to death. You're truly in the shoes of every part of nature that you've interacted with. But you also experience the wonderful things, wonderful experiences that you've had with nature, the time that you've been, many cases, most loving. I remember the case of Tom Sawyer. In his whole life review, he discovered the time that he experienced most love was when he was walking through Seneca Park in California, a child 9-10 years old. He stopped simply to admire a tree. And in his life review, he found himself inside the tree, and he experienced the tree sending photons of love back to him as a child. That was the moment in Tom Sawyer's life where he was the most unconditionally loving, where he most remembered who he was, an experience in nature, 9-10 years old. Kimberly Clark Sharp had a similar experience. At about the same age in her life review, she went back to herself as a child. The time she experienced herself most loving, most herself, most who she is, was simply watching a flower growing out of a rock. You know, she got down on her knees. She cupped it. She felt it. And she loved it. We said that these are cross-cultural experiences. A Muslim, Muhammad Z, experienced in his life review that his most loving experience, he was driving with his parents. He got out of the car with a bucket to get some water from a stream. And the bucket became too heavy for him. So he didn't want to carry that heavy bucket all the way back to the car, but he saw a tree that looked parched and drying, and he went out of his way to put the extra water in that tree, and he watched it soak through to its roots. And for him, in his whole life review, that was the time that mattered the most, that he was most himself, that he was most loving. Simple experiences with nature. But what underlines all these in the life review is the times you were most loving. I want to close with Renee Passerell, because her experience of being the most loving happened in a camp. One day she saw a child that didn't seem to be, it's like he wasn't fitting in with the other kids. He was off alone. She took 1 hour just to care for that child. I wanted him to know that he was loved, is what she said. You know, she simple things, got him a glass of water. And in her life review, she experienced that was the time in her life that mattered the most. That moment in the camp where she cared for that child, gave the child a glass of water. Now, here's the important part to me in all of these, is that Renee Passerell said, this experience that I had in camp was more important than if I had been President of the United States or the Queen of England. And why? Because she had an experience of how very simple acts of love that we do multiply and spread. She said, it's like you throw a pebble, a rock, into water, and the waves just go off in all many, many different directions. In the Life Review, you have an experience of how your action not only changed, in this case, that person at camp, that child, but all the people that child touches in his life, how it ripples out. Now, the question that we're always left with is, what if everybody had a near-death experience? What if everybody could work from those moments when they knew who they were, when they remembered who they were? Could we fight a war, you know? Could we do anything except the most loving thing in every moment of our day? That's the experience that near-death people are left with. How do we live this out? What if we were to do this every single day? The smallest things done with great love. We probably could never fight a war again, and we would probably have the planet that we all, the country, the family that we all wish for. Sheila?
I want to highlight what Denny was saying and emphasize that question. What if everyone had a near-death experience? Could we ever do anything to harm the Earth again? Could we ever knowingly harm another human being? Could we ever go to war? And just to help us to grow in that awareness, that consciousness, that understanding that people from who've had near-death experiences come back with, I want to do a simple process with you. Then we'll take a little space in case there's a question and a closing comment about how to follow up. So, for this process, please close your eyes wherever you are. Sit as comfortably as you can. Put your feet flat on the floor if you can, if you're in a place where you can do that. Breathe slowly and deeply. Just slow down your breathing and your whole system. Place your hand on your heart and imagine that you are breathing in and out through your heart. In and out through your heart. And let yourself down into the essence of yourself, which is love. Now, recall a moment when another person was kind to you in a very simple way, a way that seemed heartfelt and that touched you deeply. A moment from any time in your life. Let yourself go back in your imagination to that moment. Be there again and feel the effect upon you. Let your heart swell with gratitude or whatever else you were feeling at that time. and continue to breathe in and out, imagining that you are breathing through your heart, and let those feelings grow within you. Let them fill your whole body. And now, recall a moment when you matched the energy of kindness that you have received. A moment when you reached out to someone else in a similar way, in a spontaneous act of love, however small. It just came from deep within you, you just responded spontaneously with love to another human being or to some part of nature. And let this moment grow within you. Continue breathing in and out deeply from your heart. And find the place in yourself that deeply longs to do such things, to live from this space. Find that place. Feel it. This is your core. This is the love you are, waiting and watching for ways to express itself. And now very gradually come back. Open your eyes. Maybe wiggle your body a little bit. Come back here. Before we conclude, I wonder, Keith, do you have any questions? Anything, any of the three of us, Matt, Denny, anything more that we might want to add?
But I'm just reflecting, Sheila, on how valuable and how awesome are these stories, and I would just prefer to give the space and the time for listeners to reflect on that.
Uh-huh.
And I will give your contact information at the end of the call. Thank you.
Okay. Denny, Matt, either of you want to add anything?
Maybe just go. Why don't you just go ahead and mention how people could follow up?
Well, I would like to say one thing in closing, if neither of you does, and this comes from a woman who had a near-death experience, and this is what she says about it. If you remember when you were little and how you wish things were, that full of love and beauty, no bad things had happened yet, and no one would ever die or leave you. That's how it really is. Only a million zillion times better than we can possibly imagine. Nothing and no one that we love is ever lost. Imagine the best feeling you ever had and multiply it by a million, and that still would not describe the wonderfulness of the world we came from and to which we will return. So we want to leave you with that. And also to say that if you want to follow up, there you can do so by reading our book, the gifts of near-death experiences, which takes each stage of a near-death experience and combines it with simple processes like the one we just did to help you experience the gifts of near-death experiences in your present life, here and now. You can catch that benign virus. That's what we want for you. And we also have a free online seminar on our website. It includes short videos. Most are about 5 minutes long. These are by people who have had near-death experiences. And the videos accompany each chapter in our book. So you could use this as a kind of a seminar by yourself. You could do it with one other person or with a group. And there is a group format included. Our website is www.linministries, that's LINNMINISTRIES, .org. Thank you very much for being with us, all of you.
I just wanted to express my thanks to each of you for the time that you've been with us today and valuable information that you have shared. I believe it will truly be a blessing to all who listen. Thank you so much for this re-recording and for your many books and the such valuable contributions you've made to the healing ministry. Your work is truly appreciated, and thank you very much.
Thank you, Keith.
Thank you, Keith.
Thank you.
Thanks again to all our listeners.
Thank you. This call is now concluded. Thank you very much for being with us. God bless you all.
And you.